Hello, welcome back to a new episode of For the Love of Weather. This is the podcast where we explore the Earth's atmosphere and how we are all connected through the weather and climate. We are your hosts, Gemma and Aisling. We're both meteorologists and weather presenters and have been working in weather now for over 15 years. If you're new to the podcast, we are so thrilled to have you here with us today. And if you're coming back to us, it's amazing to know that we have your company again. And as always, we hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more and learn a little something about how the weather and climate can impact our daily lives. I'm Gemma.
And I'm Aisling. And tonight we have a very special guest, and his name is Dan Harris. Dan is the Deputy Chief Meteorologist at the UK Met Office. What a role. It's quite a mouthful as well. Basically, you support the Chief Meteorologist in a way, delivering the UK's National Weather Service and every warning that goes with it and a million other decisions about forecasting for the next 2 to 5 days. I also know Dan from back in my time when I was at Odeum, and Dan won't know this, although I'm sure I've said your name to many people before, but I just learned so much from you. The visualization of what you do and what you're capable of doing just really made the atmosphere turn into this little river and stream for me, and I probably learned the most when I was with you. So for that, I am definitely grateful. But you've been in meteorology for 15 years. You know about climate, you're interested in global weather drivers, tropical cyclones are a particular interest, as they are with Gemma as well. And you also run a really successful website, roostweather.com, which I think every single person that works in meteorology uses. And you just taught yourself at home how to do that. And it's a really successful website now. And actually, I'm a patron of the website. It's absolutely fantastic. But I mean, you have a million areas of expertise. You've taught, you know about the environment, maths, thermodynamics, dynamics. And above all of that, that is only worth all knowing if you're actually able to communicate that and deliver it to the people who need it, which you do just amazingly well. And always very grateful for any time I read your guidance as well. So thank you for that. And you're also the editor of the Royal Meteorological Society part-time, and you're one of the few people I know that are chartered meteorologists, as well as being a STEM ambassador. So you do have that passion to pass on your education. But I think one of the most loveliest things about you is that you're a Rubik's Cube master. Dan, I was looking up your statistics. You're actually a world record holder.
Former world record holder, yes.
Well, yes, yeah. But you're 10.59 seconds.
Well,
right?
Well, that's correct. That's strictly, that's not the world record. So back in the dim and distant past, I did used to hold a world record for solving most cubes underwater in one breath. There's lots of different records. Blindfolded is another one of them. I was never a world record holder at blindfold. But yeah, the one I did hold for a time was the most cubes underwater in a single breath. And that was 6. But I'm sure that's long since been beaten, though.
I don't know what to say. Oh, well, I was actually going to say, I just recently saw the world Rubik's Cube time is now 3.13 seconds. That's like, what? How did you do that?
Incredible. Well, I was never able to solve it that fast. These days, the time's absolutely crazy. The 10.59 second time, which you mentioned, was actually the fastest time at the World Championships in 2007, stretching my memory now. But to win the World Championships, you have to set the fastest average of, I think it was average of 3 or average of 5. Again, it's a little bit of a distant, hazy memory these days, particularly with 15 plus years of shift work, as you mentioned, scrambling the old brain. But yeah, it was the fastest single time. I did get a nice check and trophy for that. I was quite a proud achievement. But no, I can't claim that to be a world record, unfortunately.
And amazing. It's just incredible. And for those that don't know Dan, if you spend time with him, you'll very quickly realize how incredible his brain is. And I remember you once telling me, you were teaching me something maybe on one of a Met course, and you just said to me, well, it just falls out of the maths. And I was like, my God, his brain just thinks in numbers. This is amazing. You know, you're like, this is what, you know, I think it was, do you know what? I think it was actually supergeostrophic flow around a high pressure system. And I will forevermore remember you saying to me, but it also just falls out of the maths.
Well, that's right. The word also, I think, is quite key there. So whenever I've tried to teach meteorology to people, you yourself included, I try to have some kind of mental picture. So people that think using pictures and visualizations can try and learn the concept. And I also like to look at the mathematics behind it, because some people like to look at the maths and have an aptitude to kind of see things through the mathematical equations. So I try to look at both ways, and depending on whichever way clicks with people, then that's the way to go for.
Yeah, just amazing. Anyway, Dan, we always start off our episodes asking everyone, where was the first spark of joy where you thought to yourself, I'm probably going to work with the clouds or the weather or something?
Gosh. So for me, it would have been in the 90s. I lived, my parents' home is in East Anglia, on the east coast of Norfolk, in a near place called Great Yarmouth. That's your town is called Gorleston. And in the 90s, we had a series of summers with which were quite what they call plumey, Spanish plumes, thunderstorms coming up from France and kind of moving north. And with the vantage point on the east coast, it's quite good climatological place for to see thunderstorms coming up from the continent, and B, we had a really good vantage point out to the sea, so kind of an unobstructed view. And I, of course, I didn't know it at the time, but these kind of pretty epic thunderstorms, I can still vividly remember, you know, some of the lightning strikes, so kind of seared into my memory. And it was that that really kind of sparked an interest in weather, I think. But I've always loved the weather for as long as I can remember. Used to take photographs of clouds, and I've got a photo album up in the loft somewhere with lots of old, you know, proper photographs, not digital photographs, but you know, real developed film photographs of clouds and various things I'd taken pictures of. And my parents bought me a kind of a mini home weather station, and I remember kind of religiously going out to measure the temperature and the rainfall, and had this little wind measuring device called a ventimeter. To and wrote it all down and made graphs and tables, and so I had a kind of a love of the weather and data analysis from quite an early age, and I had sort of ambitions to become a Met Office observer. Didn't really know what that entailed at the time, but I thought, you know, I've got this nice little weather station set up in the garden. Can I send my observations off to the Met Office and, you know, be an official observer? Of course, now I know that my station would have never. Never fulfilled the criteria for being an official Met Office station, so there was no chance of that happening. And indeed, I think there was an official observation site at Gorleston, so quite close by to where I lived anyway, which I didn't know at the time. But yeah, so I had ambitions to become an observer, and then at school, I won a trip. Well, I say I won a trip to the Norwich Weather Centre. It's a bit of a niche prize, but the reason I won that prize is because my teachers knew I was interested in the weather, and so I can't remember what it was for. It's something like, you know, most number of merits in the year or something like that. But the prize was a trip to Norwich Weather Centre, and in fact, I spent the day there. Really loved it. Didn't know it at the time, but there were a couple of people there who I subsequently then went on to work with when I joined the Met Office many years later, following that. And so I just, yeah, continued that passion for weather. Did my A levels, or did my GCSEs, did my A levels, did a degree in meteorology and oceanography. I still didn't exactly know what I wanted to do, you know, specifically when graduating, but I always knew I wanted to have a career in weather. And so took my degree in meteorology and oceanography, which was a third maths, third oceanography, third meteorology at the UEA. And following that, quite quickly was accepted onto a place in the Met Office IFC as it was then. And that was, yeah, I mean, say 15 years, I think it must be October 2007, so getting on for 16 and a half years ago.
That's exactly the same time that I started my job.
October 2007.
Well, maybe mine might have been September, but yeah, it was definitely September, October 2007. Yeah.
Cool.
So you're coming up on 17 years as well, Gemma. We thought it was 16, so it's coming up on 17.
Yep.
Wow. I trust Dan's maths.
I'm not sure I would. I've just come off the back of two quite difficult day shifts. Well, actually, the first one wasn't that difficult, but today was a bit unsatisfactory, shall we say, in the way the forecast went towards the end of the day. So, and after doing two day shifts with early starts, and I haven't had some early starts before that, yeah, the brain's a little bit tired. So you have to apologise
Yeah.
for making any mistakes or forget things. But
We wouldn't
so,
notice.
the
We're in the same position. For those listening, it's actually 9 p.m. at night. So Dan is trying to do all of this after doing all of the stuff and his shift and the family stuff at home. So it's interesting, as you were just talking about the handover there. I just love One of the things I actually love about my job is that actually the weather moves on and you have to let go, don't you? Like, you can only go on the information that you have at the time, and you make your best estimate of that and you do your best every single day. And sometimes that works out great, and sometimes it doesn't work out as you thought. So how has that been for you as a like a process or a learning process?
I mean, to some degrees, I agree with you. Some ways I agree, but I think the scales that we look at are slightly different. So, you're doing your, I guess, your forecast primarily for, say, the next day, when you're doing your forecasts. My main focus for my role these days is the medium range, and you mentioned kind of days 2 to 5. Do look at the short range as well, but not as closely. So my main focus is on kind of days 2 to 5, and then 6 and 7, and then beyond that, which we call the extended range, which is days 8 to 30. So I look across that whole scale, looking across the whole of the UK. Obviously, the different kind of time scales you're looking at informs the different kind of level of detail you can pick out of things. But the main point I want to make is with the, say, for example, the 2 day shifts I've just had, what was kind of day 2 to 5 yesterday is now kind of day 1 to 4 today. So actually, I do get to see the same forecast multiple times and see how it evolves. And that does kind of mean that sometimes you can't let it go because you've still got to look at the damn thing. And particularly at this time of year when you get springtime blocking and messy patterns developing, predictability in the medium range can vary quite markedly. And at the moment, the predictability for next week seems to take a little bit of a nosedive, and hence the kind of dissatisfaction in the forecast when I had sight of the 12Z models. But in terms of the short range forecast, I mean, obviously we're looking at short range as well, and then you get to see it happen and verify. But you will always want to check back and to see how your forecast went, because that by doing that you can see what you missed, mostly what you missed, what you can learn for next time. And one kind of key thing, I suppose, that you get from looking back at the forecasts and not just letting them go into the past and not trying to learn anything from them, is you quickly get a sense that no matter what you do, you can't get the forecast right, because there is only one right answer and there's infinitely many wrong answers depending on the kind of level of accuracy and detail you're looking into it. So there's always something to learn, there's always something to look at, and there's always something that you can look at and think, yeah, I've done a good job there, and feel pleased about.
That is so true. God, I've never really heard it described exactly like that. But yes, the forecast is never right, depending on what scale you look at it at. But it's a really good way. I want to ask you something, because both of you, right, have been in the career at your same time. And Dad, we'd love to chat to you tonight about sting jets. So can you like talk us through the evolution of sort of how you've seen satellite change, information change, how much easier it is to forecast those things, something like a sting jet? How do you do it? Can you tell us a bit about the history of the sting jet?
Gosh, sting jets. When we had the Great Storm of 1987, so I was 2. Going to go off on a slight tangent here, but yeah, I'd have been 2 and a half, and we had a fence blow down in our garden, so in Gorleston. And at the time, it was believed that Gorleston had recorded the highest wind speed in the Great Storm of 1987, October the 15th and into the 16th. But it turned out actually that after inspection, the anemometer cups had been vandalized, and so I think the gust measured was something like 122 miles an hour, but it turned out that the anemometer was reading far too high because it's vandalism. And I think the record is now, or I think the highest gust was something like 100 miles an hour at Shoreham, from memory, but you may have to go back and look that up. But the reason for kind of bringing that up, I missed it at the time. We were in a family holiday in Corfu. But it wasn't known at the time that the very strong winds that affected the southeast and caused absolute chaos, millions of trees down across the southeast, was the result of a sting jet. And that wasn't known at the time. And then fast forward a couple of decades later, we had the St. Jude's Day storm, which was 2013, October the 28th, I think. And I was on shift at Wattisham Airfield in Suffolk, and I actually got to experience a sting jet firsthand. So having gone from kind of meteorologists not being aware of them, by 2013, meteorologists kind of really knew about the process of sting jets, and we started to have high enough resolution models to be able to resolve these kind of features. Yeah, that was a real kind of experience to behold. It was a night shift on the Sunday night, and we kind of watched the Sting jet develop and propagate across the southwest first, and then it kind of went across the Salisbury Plain area to north of London, and then smacked Wattisham with a 60 plus knot gust. I forget the exact figure, but it was a very some very strong gusts, a period of very strong winds. So strong, we went outside to experience it and found it very hard to stand up. So yeah, that was a yeah, really fascinating from my point of view. In terms of what we look for as meteorologists, in terms of Sting jets, first of all, it kind of starts with a bit of theory and kind of knowledge of the conceptual models of how Sting jets form. And so one of the key signatures we tend to look for in the models are a cyclone evolution, which is known as the Shapiro-Kieser evolution, or it could be Shapiro-Kieser. I'm not entirely sure exactly how you pronounce it, but that was developed in the early 90s. And in contrast to what we call the Norwegian cyclone model, which is a model of low pressure development, weather system development that's kind of really stood the test of time for the past 100 years or more, this was a different way of looking at how cyclones developed. And it turns out that Shapiro-Kieser cyclones are more preferentially tend to form in the Western Atlantic. And in fact, that's kind of where the first observational campaigns and experiments were focused and kind of discovered these systems at the West Atlantic, because they form at the western end of the storm track. And Norwegian cyclones are more commonly found at the eastern end of the storm track, or in over the Eastern Atlantic, Northern Europe. And that's why they were kind of identified by the Norwegians. So it kind of nicely follows. And you tend to find that these cyclones evolve from Shapiro-Kieser cyclones into Norwegian cyclones as they go through their kind of life cycle. It doesn't always happen like that, but you do tend to find that. So it means you start off with a Shapiro-Kieser type system and you end up with a Norwegian mature system by the time it reaches the UK most often. Doesn't always happen though. And the things that we tend to look out for in the Shapiro-Kieser model are things like very strong warm fronts. The Shapiro-Kieser cyclones tend to be kind of oriented east to west, and elongated in that fashion. The warm fronts tend to be very active with lots of rain, strong thermal gradients. Whereas the cold front, in contrast to a Norwegian cyclone, and we're quite familiar in the UK with these kind of quite active, squally cold fronts that come through, associated with Norwegian type cyclones. In the Shapiro-Kieser cyclone, the cold front tends to be much weaker. It's much thermally less well defined, particularly towards the centre of the system, and you end up with something called a frontal fracture. And once you've identified this kind of frontal fracture, the thermally strong warm front, the zonal elongation, as we call it, you're kind of part most of the way there to identifying this thing as a Shapiro-Kieser cyclone. Now, the reason for kind of labouring that point is because its Sting jets are typically associated with Shapiro-Kieser cyclones, I think almost kind of universally. And within these cyclones, there's kind of three distinct wind flows. There's what we call the warm conveyor, so that's the flow ahead of the cold front, and it typically defines the warm sector. And where the warm conveyor lifts off the surface, that's where you find the warm front. You've also got another flow called the cold conveyor belt, that wraps underneath the warm conveyor belt and around the kind of northern and western flanks of the cyclone. And as that comes around the centre of the low pressure, that forms another swathe of very strong winds, known as the cold conveyor belt swathe. And the Sting jet exists in an area kind of near to the frontal fracture. It's to the rear of the cold front, but it's ahead of this cold conveyor belt jet. And it's a very distinct flow of air that only lasts kind of order hours. But it exists in a very narrow filament, and it's a distinct flow from the warm conveyor belt and the cold conveyor belt jet. Now, they're quite often hard to see in traditional surface observations, particularly because the Sting jet and the cold conveyor belt often exist very close together. The cold conveyor belt will eventually wrap around the cyclone and take over the position where the Sting jet was, and it kind of cuts off the Sting jet. So it can often be difficult to identify in things like surface observations. But where we would most easily identify a Sting jet would be in satellite observations. So signatures on water vapor, such as the dry intrusion, which is an area of dry stratospheric air cutting across the center of the cyclone. Now, some people confuse that with the Sting Jet. In some places, you'll read, oh, you've got the stratospheric air has descended all the way down to the surface and formed the Sting Jet. That's not quite how it happens. But the dry intrusion is a signature that we look for because that's indicative of explosive cyclogenesis, a rapid deepening of the low. And it's at that time where you start to find the Sting Jet. The Sting Jet itself actually originates most probably from the mid-troposphere. It's a distinct, as I mentioned, it's a distinct flow from the cold conveyor belt, which tends to form underneath that. But trajectory analysis tends to show that it comes from sort of the mid-troposphere and descends down to the top of the boundary layer, eventually penetrates the boundary layer and is realized as very strong winds at the surface. The most telling signature that we see is usually on infrared, and you tend to find these kind of fingers of cloud. So where you have the high cloud wrapping around the low pressure center, you'll see these kind of spikes of cloud pointing downwards, and that's kind of a an actual physical representation of the air flowing around the cyclone and descending, because as it descends, it dries and the cloud evaporates. So you're left with these kind of tendrils of cloud that then evaporate, and the Sting Jet is a drier flow of air which then continues to descend, and is realized at the surface. So those key things that we look at for the imagery, those kind of fingers, and also on water vapor, sometimes you can, particularly colored water vapor imagery, actually, you can see these kind of really intense pockets of dry air that almost look as though they hit the surface and splay out. And so when you see those, you can be fairly confident that you've identified a Sting Jet.
Is there anything that you can look at beforehand? So obviously when you're looking at the forecast of a storm moving in, is there anything that might indicate to you, or this could possibly have a Sting Jet, or is it something that you have to sort of watch as the observations and the satellites coming in to be like, oh, actually maybe a Sting Jet's developing now?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, obviously, looking at the NWP, and we're looking for this Shapiro-Kieser evolution. So, as soon as we see that kind of evolution, one of the things we'll be thinking about, right, there's potential for Sting Jet here. And in now we have high-res modeling, high-resolution models can explicitly resolve and model these types of phenomenon. So, if it's in the model, it's clearly a possibility. The model probably won't have it in the right place at the right time and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, certainly if the model's giving you a good indication of a narrow sway, the strong winds in the right place, then that's sort of, yeah, evidence that a potential Sting Jet could form. There are also other diagnostics that we have, kind of experimental diagnostics, which look at a property called conditional slantwise instability. And one of the theories behind Sting Jet formation is slantwise instability. So you're probably familiar with instability in the sense of showers and convection. That's kind of static instability, which is kind of upright convection. So the convective cells go up and down. Whereas in slantwise instability, the atmosphere might not necessarily be unstable from a buoyancy perspective, but the atmosphere also obeys a property called conservation of absolute momentum. And occasionally you can get setups where these momentum gradients are configured such that you end up with instability in a almost a kind of 45 degree angle type scenario. So two ways that can manifest. Well, one way it tends to manifest on radar imagery is you kind of see these bands of rain, and the bands of rain are kind of associated with where the air is ascending, and then the gaps in between are associated where the kind of rolls are descending. And it's thought that the kind of descending limb of this slantwise instability is one of the mechanisms by which a Sting Jet can propagate to the surface. So one of the diagnostics we've got looks at whether there is conditional slantwise instability in the models, and when it's kind of flagging that associated with a cyclone, then again you've got evidence that there's a potential for a Sting Jet there.
I'm having this gorgeous feeling again of learning something. I just love it. I love it. It's like I love that. My brain is a bit surprised. I understand what you're talking about because I thought I'd forgotten a lot of this information. But what I think I am surprised about is I don't recall actually having an understanding that a Kaiser Shapiro type of system was formed in the West Atlantic. I actually don't think I knew that. I don't think that was something I knew. So what you're saying is the fronts are like more like east west, and then it's the warm front that's more active. So it's a slight.
Yeah, so they don't always, they're preferential in the West Atlantic because they are associated with the development area of a jet right entrance. So
Oh,
if you
okay.
think of your kind of four quadrant model of a jet, you've got the main development areas are in the jet left exit and the jet right entrance. And because the Atlant, you know, the average westerly current across the Atlantic is for the polar jet to kind of enter into the West Atlantic and exit in the East Atlantic. Preferentially, you know, climatologically, you get a jet right entrance in the West Atlantic and a jet left exit in the East Atlantic. And it's the right entrances, it's kind of the accelerating flow into the right entrance that favors this kind of zonal elongation of the system. And then the kind of, then the evolution of the Shapiro-Kieser type system, where it's when once those systems cross onto the cold side of the jet and then kind of find themselves more into a jet left exit, or these systems can kind of create their own jet left exits. Because one evolution you often see is that with a Shapiro-Kieser system, a very strong warm front, you get strong polar warm advection, and what that does is it buckles the jet, so you go from a nice straight jet to a kind of a more of a wiggly jet. And when you get a wiggly jet, you end up creating a left exit for the system to move into, and then it starts to kind of deepen explosively, but then undergo more Norwegian cyclone type processes. So all of these cyclones exist on a spectrum, and they don't always form, like you don't always get SK systems in the West Atlantic and always get Norwegian ones in the East Atlantic. Depends on the configuration of the thermal gradient and the configuration of the jet, polar front jet on the day. But climatologically, that you tend to get them preferentially in the West Atlantic and Norwegian ones in East Atlantic.
I love it. I love it.
This is another one of
It's
those
crazy.
conversations when it just makes you realize how amazing the atmosphere is.
I
Oh,
absolutely,
know.
yeah,
Just
absolutely.
about just oh my God. And do you know what I'm always saying this. I'm so amazed at the programmers that sit down and program this. Like they have to like constantly make these tweaks to an imperfect atmosphere. Like it genuinely blows my mind. That's slantwise convection as well. I miss so much having all those diagnostics. Like there's so many goodies in the Met Office. The development of science is just unbelievable. And actually, for those that are listening, you probably who do listen or at least know myself and Gemma or anyone from the Met Office, you'll know who Eddie Carroll is. And he was just an incredible developer of all of this stuff. I always thought you were going to be the next Eddie Carroll.
I wish. No, I don't. Couldn't aspire to those heights, but you do what you can. And I mean, I really, I'm really lucky to have a job that I love. And you know, I think if you have a job that you love and you're motivated to keep improving and developing, then that only, I don't know, just reinforces the love for the job, right? You know, the more you know, the more competent you can be at something, the more interesting it is. And with weather, you know, you can never stop learning. It's one of those things where the more you know, the more you realize you don't know and you have to find out. And yeah, I will have a long career in meteorology, and by the end of it, I won't know.
You'd be knackered.
Well, I mean, yes, that's true, but I won't know, you know, a tenth of, hundredth of the stuff that you could know about meteorology.
I think we're so lucky though, right? Because I think the day you stop learning in your job, it's time to go. You know, it means you're not interested anymore. And there's just so much to learn.
We've spoken about sting jets, and I feel like we could talk about sting jets for the whole episode, but we're actually going to move on and talk about how we can visualize climate data and weather data, because obviously you've got this website which I'm sure a lot of us use when it comes to weather forecasting. But why do you think it's important to be able to visualize that data and have it available for people to use?
Right. That's a big subject. It's a big question. The main motivation for me, and I think for many people, to have very good, very quick access to climatology is to put the forecast into context. So I'll give you a non-UK based example. So one of the features I have on my web page is a world climatology map. So it pulls together data from the Met Office for around the UK. It uses DWD climate data, which they make freely available. So climate messages are kind of like monthly summaries that lots of stations around the world submit, and the German Weather Service, DWD, they quality control them and then they disseminate them free to access. There's another large data set from NCEI. I can't remember exactly what the acronym stands for, but it's essentially the climate part of NOAA in the US. So there's a number of different sources which come together and give climate information about stations around the world. And one of the jobs I do at the Met Office, as well as looking after the medium and extended range, some of my shifts are devoted to our global guidance bench, where we produce forecasts for areas of significant weather around the globe. And when you've been a forecaster for the UK, you know, for as long as I have, or not even for as long as I have, and you build up a kind of sense of what's normal for the UK at various times of year, you know, what kind of temperatures you can expect on average, what kind of rainfall you can expect on average. You build up a feeling for that gradually over the years. But then if you think you've got to expand that to the whole world, and you think how many different kind of climate types, where climate zones and weather types around the world. You've got tropics with the tropical cyclones, mid latitudes, you've got the deserts, you know, just so many different areas of weather, so many different kind of seasonalities in rainfall, wet seasons, dry seasons. So you can't hope to know any of that. So the question is, if you've identified an area of heavy rainfall over an area, how do you know if that's going to be significant or not? And the only way you can really know is by putting it into a climatic context. And so I developed this World Climate page to be able to look at what typical rainfall or temperatures are at specific locations at specific times of year, compare that with what is being forecast. And at a glance, you can then say, oh, okay, yeah, that 500 millimeters of rainfall that we're there expecting over the next week, that's fairly typical in monsoon season or whatever. So, or this 100 millimeters of rain that they're expecting in the dry season is actually nothing compared to what they get in the wet season, so they can cope with it. So that was the primary driver for me, to put the forecast into context and to help give more intelligent advice about a forecaster, rather than just saying, you know, the weather will be this. You can say the weather will be this, and the so what of that is, or the impacts of this weather are. So that's I guess the primary driver. The secondary driver, particularly for UK climate, is, as you probably already gathered, I'm a bit of a data nerd, a bit of a nerd generally, but that's okay. But I kind of love looking at the stats and the extremes and the records. And you'll see a lot of the things on my webpage are dedicated to kind of seeing how this month's climate compares with other months or other years, or have we broken the record? Is this the wettest March, July on average? All those kind of things. So a lot of the areas on my website are kind of dedicated to that, and also, yeah, things like daily extremes, so maximum, minimum. I don't find those quite as interesting. I've found it's funny the way it's evolved, actually, because I think my interest and passion for climate and data analysis has actually been enhanced by developing stuff for the website, rather than me actually developing stuff for the website, because I've had the kind of strong interest at the start of it. So the way my website came about actually was just looking for something to do when we had the lockdowns in the COVID pandemic. I knew a little bit about coding, and one of my colleagues at work, very faithfully, and I'll give a name check actually, Katie Howard, she faithfully came up to me on one, I think it was a night shift, and said, did you know you can get sign-up data off OGMET by using this script? And there's a particular page on OGMET where you can just kind of, you know, send it a request and it returns you the sign-up observations. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Because before that, I'd actually just built a little website to display the data from my home weather station and webcams and things like that. But once I got access to this UK data, I thought, oh, I'll see what I can do with this. And I wrote a little kind of script to decode the sign-ups and extract things like the wind and the temperature and the pressure and put them in a database. And then basically from that, it's just exploded and ballooned. And I've kind of learned how to code and analyze data and use databases and SQL and PHP and all this kind of good stuff, basically through just seeing, you know, oh, okay, can we see if we can analyze what's the average date of the 20, you know, the first 20 degrees in the year or something like that, and just seeing what data we've got, seeing how we can manipulate it, analyze it, seeing how we can visualize it. And yeah, the website is kind of built up from that.
I have two things to say. First of all, Katie Howard, thank you so much. My life is so much better every day. Second of all, I thought that was called Augie Met. So for years, I've been saying
No,
Augie
please do keep saying Ogimet, because I mean I've
Met
no idea. I've always said Ogimet, but
That's pretty, it's pretty amazing though. I just love that story. I just think it's absolutely fascinating. And you know what? And you're absolutely right. It's putting it into context. So the type of forecasting I do now is so different. But really, just some days you want to know, like if I took an umbrella out yesterday, will I need to take it today? If I had a scarf on yesterday, will I need my scarf tomorrow? If I have the kids at the playground, do I want to, you know, it's the how does it compare to my most recent memory? And you're right, it's very hard to contextualize, give a useful forecast if you haven't contextualized it. It's like just saying it's 10 degrees, but you're not saying, well, that's normal or that's not normal or it's cold or it's warm or whatever.
That's right. And you did actually, having said that, you've reminded me of the third, which is actually probably the second. So we'll relegate my kind of nerdery to the third position. One thing which my pages, you know, obviously I've got a vested interest in it and I say it with complete bias, but one of the things I think my pages do very well, and it's quite niche actually in the world of weather websites, is it has a very long history and record of observational data. So a lot of the weather websites that you kind of can find on the internet have model data on. You know, there's some really fantastic model visualization pages out there, and they're fed with, you know, hundreds of different models. You've got the ECMWF pages, you've got artificial intelligence models now, you know, AI, NWP. But actually, if you want to find out what the maximum gust at Manston Airport was on January the 5th this year, then you're very hard pressed to actually find that data, because a lot of sites will kind of display current data and maybe a little bit of history, maybe up to a week. But yeah, it's quite difficult to get historical data. And actually, because I've got the a data set called MyDAS Open, which the Met Office make available via CEDA. I think it's the Centre for Environmental Data Analysis, I think, CEDA. I've actually got data which goes back to 1853, which I don't, you know, unless you've actually got direct access to the MyDAS data set, which is quite difficult to get your head around. It's difficult to get hold of it. So yeah, that's another, but bringing it back to kind of, I guess, the here and now, things like when we are considering rainfall warnings, for example. One very quick thing to look at will just be what the cut, you know, I've got an area on my site where you can look at how much rain has fallen across an area over a certain time period and see whether that's more or less than normal. And that's quite a quick, at a glance, you know, if we're expecting some heavy rain in an area, is this area more sensitive or less sensitive because of what's happened over the past week or two? Of course, we get all a lot of that information from Flood Forecasting Centre, we have a close collaboration with, in this specific example. But if you just want a kind of quick, at a glance, kind of situational awareness type assessment of what the antecedent conditions are, as we would call them, then yeah, a number of the tools I've developed on there have been geared towards getting that situational awareness to help, again, improve the forecast going forward and the advice you can give.
A treat when you've had a week off. You come in and you're like, I've just ingested everything.
You can also tell as well that it's been developed by someone that works
Yeah.
in meteorology, because the feature that you just mentioned, how you can cut like you can customize the time that you look at the rainfall. I find that that's some one of the features that I use on the website because it's great. And I'll be like, okay, I want to know the rainfall between this time and this time, how much fell. Oh, I've got them there straight away. I've got them good to go. So you can tell that it's been developed by someone that works in forecasting.
Gemma said, you know, you can tell it's been done by someone that works in meteorology. And my kind of response to that is, yeah, you can't, unfortunately, that means you can't expect the slickest, flashiest web design experience, but you can at least get the data that you want.
I love your website. Everybody does. Everyone knows it.
Yeah,
It's opened
everyone
up
does.
every day on so many desktops. It's unbelievable. So Dan, do you think you could tell us really quickly, how do you summarize everything that you just told us? What is the Sting Jet?
A sting jet is a narrow ribbon of very strong winds, which forms in association with a weather system that we call a Shapiro-Kieser or Kieser cyclone. Now, these types of cyclones or low pressure systems tend to form in the West Atlantic. They form in the right entrance of the polar front jet, and you can identify them by certain things such as very strong warm fronts. They tend to be elongated from east to west and have quite weak cold fronts. And that's distinctive from another type of cyclone, which we identify called the Norwegian cyclone. So when these low pressure systems undergo this evolution called Shapiro-Kieser evolution, you end up with a frontal fracture, and the sting jet is this distinct flow of air which forms just to the rear of the cold front and ahead of another jet, which we call the cold conveyor belt jet. And you can identify these on satellite imagery in a couple of ways. If you look at the infrared imagery, you can see these nice spikes forming on the cloud, these tendrils descending from the high cloud sheet, and that's kind of indicative of the air descending from the mid troposphere and forming the sting jet at the surface. And also on an imagery called water vapor imagery, you often get a really nice signal that a sting jet has occurred when you see a nice patch of dry, warm air splaying out across the surface, usually to the south or to the east of the cyclone center.
Brilliant. I'm going to try and memorize that. I might actually write that down next time I'm in work and someone says that. I'd be like, yeah, sure. That is normally forms in the Western Atlantic.
It is, 'cause
Because
you read about sting
honestly,
jets and you read all the papers
I've
on it,
never
but there was
learned it
this,
like that. Yeah.
yeah, but it's just the way that you were talking about it. I could actually,
Visualize.
it's what Ash was talking about at the beginning. I could actually visualize the dry air coming down, what it would look like on the satellite. Like I could actually visualize it.
So Dan uses this, in the Met Office, these visualization graphics. His imagery, the way he like codes up everything to view it, is just like, if you don't get it in numbers, you'll get it in the pictures. It just like brings 3D to life, like on 2D. It's pretty amazing. We're a big fan, Dan. Right,
Yeah,
but
I was going to say, can I click your testimonial at the beginning? I'm going to write that down and have it somewhere on my
yeah,
on my
when I'm
bedside.
having a bad day.
Yeah, I'll get it framed
Yeah.
up on the
We
office
love Dan, yeah.
wall.
Right, Dan, it has been just amazing to talk to you. I have a feeling we could just go on and on. I'm picking your brains about stuff, but we're gonna move on to something called a little get to know me round to find out what you're interested in when you're not interested in the weather. Gemma.
Okay, so some of these are weather related, and then some of them are just very random. So we always start by asking our guests what their favourite season is.
Spring. Because I'm not a huge fan of the hot weather. Equally, I'm not a huge fan of the cold weather. So spring's a nice happy medium, and also you've got the nice longer days stretching out ahead of you to look forward to.
Here, here, spring is the best season ever, and I totally agree. If you're not forecasting in it, it's fabulous.
What's your favorite cloud?
It's got to be a cumulonimbus. I mean, there's some quite niche types of cloud that I could reference, but really, the cumulonimbus is the only one that really makes me want to get the camera out and start taking pictures. So, yeah, it's got to be a cumulonimbus.
What are the niche ones? What are the niche ones?
Well, things like, I guess, lenticular clouds or nacreous clouds or things like that, I suppose. But other basically clouds that are other than the basic 10 cloud types, I suppose. But yeah, it's got to be a CB.
I don't think that you can ever have too many pictures of clouds. My camera reel is full of clouds, and
Yeah.
I will continue to take a picture of a cloud almost daily.
I must admit, yeah, the clouds for me these days, apart from a CB, what I tend to get my camera out for most is like optical phenomena. So things like halos or sun dogs or circumzenithal arcs, rainbows, that kind of thing.
They're pretty stunning. And actually, every time one comes around or one comes in, I'm like, oh, I need to remember again exactly how to describe that. I know most of it is to do with refraction of light through ice, but at the same time, I'm still like, okay, how does that happen again? I find I go through these cycles where I'm talking about something all the time and it's all fresh in my mind, and then, or like the season changes and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that pattern, surface pattern or whatever, you know. I have to constantly keep relearning stuff, which is great.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I'd quite like to be able to shoot lightning bolts from my hands. That would be really cool, wouldn't
It's World Book Day today, isn't that what it is? That would be cool. What would you do with that?
I don't know. I think if you ever got into an argument with someone, you could just sort of end it by some pow, and then they'd back down.
Funny.
But
That's brilliant. I think that's
I mean,
probably the best answer so far to that question we've had.
as you could
Yeah.
probably tell, I've not really given that one a huge amount of thought.
It's brilliant.
Okay, our next question for you is, if you had to choose, would you prefer the beach or the mountains?
The mountains, definitely. I like walking. I quite like, not a climber per se, but I wouldn't mind walking up a mountain, but don't really like the feeling of the sand on the beach. So, yeah, mountains definitely.
I do love a good mountain, whether you're climbing up it or you can just see it in the distance. They
I
are
want a
beautiful.
beach by the mountain. I love them both. That's what I want.
You could climb a mountain and then end at a beach and then have a relaxing afternoon at the beach.
I mean, that would be lovely.
That would be ideal. And then a lovely sunset by the coast.
Yeah.
Perfect day.
Where you get a perfect sundown.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in a cloud inversion. And
Dream day, that is, that
then.
is.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a couple more. So if you were a fruit or vegetable, what would you be?
If I were a fruit or a vegetable, I would say a tomato because I'm often misunderstood.
Ah, that's a fantastic answer.
So two more questions. If you can invite one person to dinner, it can be anybody at all from any historical time frame or even a fictional character, who would you invite?
So that's quite an easy one, I think. I would invite Jewel Charney. So he's often kind of credited as one of the founding fathers of dynamical meteorology. He developed the independently along with other people, but he was kind of is credited with developing the quasi-geostrophic set of equations, which some of the first numerical models were based off, and things like the Omega equation, which all meteorologists are familiar with, kind of fall out of these equations. And he was a really fascinating guy. And actually, I did a Met Office kind of Hall of Fame podcast on him a little while ago, in case anyone wants to go and look back on that. But yeah, fascinating character. Would have loved to have met him, and but we didn't coincide in terms of time frames, unfortunately. And so yeah, I'd invite him to dinner.
Amazing. I would actually, do you know, one of my lecturers in UCD was a massive, massive fan of his. And actually, I think he might have been his PhD student or something, because Charney was in the 1950s, wasn't he? Yeah, I think he might have been his student at some point. He used to go on about him all the time, but I can see his image in my head. Fascinating. If only you could say to him, look what you started. This is amazing. So my last question, Dan, to you is, if you went into work and you could only pick one item to forecast with. So what I mean is, would you be looking at a satellite? Would you look at a radio sonde of a Teffy? Would you look at a surface pressure chart? If you could only look at the time scale of three things and it has to be the same thing and it's only one thing, what would you choose?
So okay, do they have they all have to be grounded in observations, do they? Okay. I would say a satellite sequence with radar overlays. Can I
Yeah, you can, you can. I'm
have
gonna give you that.
that? Yeah, satellite sequence of radar overlaid.
Ah, interesting.
And quite a large scale one as well, so you can kind of see the larger scale developments.
Yeah, it's, do you know, it's probably that probably highlights as well our differences. I would choose a Teffygram, but I've always done smaller scale forecasting, you know, the little nitty-gritty, the detail. And fascinating. So you choose a top down rather than the bottom up.
I agree with Dan. I would go for the same as well.
Yeah.
Satellite with radar over it.
Well, there we go. That's answered a question of mine that I'm always like thinking, I just want a Teffy Grahams. I do miss seeing Teffy Grahams though, actually. Is there anywhere to view Teffy Grahams for free?
Yeah, so pivotalweather.com
I
is a great
don't know this.
site for looking at model Teffy Grahams, and there's a website called, I think it's rawwindsond.com, and that.
Is the pivotal for the now, the ones that are done today?
No, so for actuals now, there's the University of Wyoming website, which, yeah, gives you the full suite. So you've got Raw Insond for your Era 5 reanalysis type ones. You've got the University of Wyoming for the actual observational ones. And you've got Pivotal Weather for model soundings. Teffygrams are fantastic tools as well, of course. So much you can get from Teffygrams. And I was fortunate enough just this week to actually take part in a course at work, now of course led by some of my colleagues who I work with in my team, that are kind of experts in convection and thunderstorms and convective weather. And when it comes to those kind of things, teffygrams and hodographs are invaluable tools in the armory. So you're right, it really does depend on the scale. But I'm thinking more of a general forecast for the UK satellite imagery if I'm looking. But the thing is, if you want to then go to what the teffygram is showing you, you kind of really need to have knowledge of the background environment that's forming, or that the teffygram is for, to be able to kind of put it into context again and make a useful forecast on it, I
This
would
is
say.
disaster recovery, and you're on holiday for a month, you know. Hypothetical, hypothetical, hypothetical. Right, Dan. We're going to have to finish up. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think myself and Gemma have an endless list of questions for you. Hopefully you'll come back on the
Yeah, I'll have
podcast.
to come on again. It's been fun.
It'd be really good. I've like other things I want to talk to you about, but there's just not enough time. Also, so Dan, if anyone wants to follow you, do you want to just give the details of your address and where to find you as well on X?
Absolutely.
Is
So
it?
I'm at Roost Weather on X. My website is www.roostweather.com.
Brilliant. And if people want to follow us on Instagram, we are For the Love of Weather on X, formerly Twitter. We are the number four Love of Weather. And it would be great if you could subscribe, rate, and review the podcast and share it. It really helps other people find our podcast. And as always, we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more.
Thanks for listening. Bye.